ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। This is an evening that all of our assembled devotees await throughout the year. We are so very grateful to Yash and Avanti and their family for opening the doors to their wonderful home for all of us to hear and chant the message of the Lord. Tonight is especially auspicious. It is the Magh Purnima, the full moon night of the month of Magh. It was on this day that one of the greatest spiritual teachers of history took his birth in this world, Srila Narottam Das Thakur. He was the son of a king, a prince who was the sole heir to all of the wealth and power of the kingdom. But as a child, in the association of a very dear devotee of Lord Chaitanya named Krishna Das, he was continually yearning to hear more and more about Lord Krishna and his devotees. And he was especially very, very eager to hear about the lives of those who loved God. It became such an obsession in his life that he was longing to be amongst such saintly persons and yearning to dedicate his life, his soul, his everything to the service of the Lord. It is a beautiful story. At the birthplace of Narottam Das Thakur, not long ago, we gave a brief summary of his life history. And we couldn't speak for less than 6 hours. But tonight I will spare you that austerity. And I can say just a few things. How Narottam Das Thakur, he was crying in separation from the Lord. And Lord Chaitanya, who is the most munificent and merciful incarnation of Lord Krishna, appeared to him in a dream and told him to go to Vrindavan. So Narottam, who was still a child, he left secretly through the forests. His father and mother sent detectives to search for him. And they found him deep into the forest, all alone, traveling by footpaths from Kethuri, which is in Bangladesh, to Vrindavan. I believe it's over 1,000 kilometers. And he was walking alone. Where will he get food? Who will protect him? These concerns never even crossed the footpath of his mind. He was going to Vrindavan, the eternal land of Krishna, the place that so many unlimited saints have taken shelter of since time immemorial. And Lord Chaitanya told him that there you will accept Lokanath Goswami as your spiritual master. The detectives found him many days into his travel. They were going to take him home by force. But Narottam Das Thakur was so pure, so innocent. His love was so deep. He explained to them that he has already given his heart to Krishna. And he talked to them in such sweet words that not only did they release him, but they gave him some money to help him with his trip. And he went to Vrindavan. And that is a beautiful story, his life in Vrindavan. He met Jiva Goswami at Radha Govinda's temple. And Jiva Goswami brought him to the great Vaishnavas. When he came before Lokanath Goswami, he fell at his lotus feet and begged Lokanath Goswami to accept him as his disciple. But Lokanath Goswami explained, "In my life, I have never accepted a disciple. I am not qualified. I have no real love for God. What can I do for anyone else? Now in my old age, and my dearest masters, Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, they have departed from this world. I have no capacity to train anyone in the path of devotion. It is not possible. Besides that, the Lord has appeared to you several times. He has sent you to Vrindavan. You've already seen Krishna. How can I help you? I am insignificant." Narottam Das Thakur, he cried. That was his sincerity. He said, I am lost in this world of dualities and illusions. Without the grace of a spiritual master, there is no hope for me. But still, Narottam Das Thakur did not want to disturb Lokanath Goswami's sentiment. Lokanath Swami would not accept any service for himself from anyone because he considered himself so unqualified. Narottam Das Thakur, he wanted so deeply to serve this great soul, but he didn't want to embarrass him. So he did it secretly. You know, in those days, there was no modern plumbing. In a place like Vrindavan, people would go into the forest, respond to the calls of Mother Nature, and then wash themselves, and then enter into the river Yamuna to take bath. That was how people would begin their days, very early in the morning, when it was still dark, before the sun rises. Lokanath Goswami noticed that every day, everything was so clean and fresh with fragrance. How is this possible? He was wondering, what's happening? So one morning, He rose especially early and went there, hiding behind bushes and trees to see what happens to make that place so fresh and clean every morning so early before he responds to nature's calls. And he saw Narottam Das Thakur, that great scholar and prince, with tears of affection streaming from his eyes, cleaning the place with his own hands and sweeping it as if he was cleaning the altar of the Lord, as if he was doing seva for the holy deity. When Lokanath Swami saw this, he was shocked, beside himself. He burst from the bushes and cried out, exclaiming, Narottam, Narottam, why? Why are you doing this? You are a prince. You are coming from royalty. Why are you cleaning my degraded stool and urine with your hands? Why? Narottam Das Thakur hung his head low in humility and revealed the content of his heart. He said, my dear Guru Maharaj, I have left the illusory riches of this world, which all culminate in death. I have left everything, and I have achieved the ultimate perfection of all my desires, the supreme spiritual treasure of menial, humble service to a great soul. Seeing his sincerity and hearing his words, Lokanath Goswami's heart melted, and he accepted Narottam Das Thakur as his disciple, the one and only in his life. He gave him the initiation into Radha Krishna's mantra. Narottam Das Thakur spent his life absorbed in relishing the nectar of the holy name, in tasting the sweetness of Krishna's beautiful pastimes, in worshiping Krishna's all-beautiful form. And on the order of his Gurudev, he went from Vrindavan back to Khetri. And his Guru Maharaj gave him two instructions prominently. He said, you should always take the name of the Lord and broadcast in a spirit of compassion to the common people the great message of pure love of God and worship the Lord in his deity form. Narottam Das Thakur, he attracted literally millions of people to the path of pure devotion to God simply by his humble example, the purity of his love, and the profound nature of his speaking. He wrote thousands of songs even today. In our temples all over the world, every single day we sing his songs. In the morning during our Guru Puja to our beloved Guru Maharaj Srila Prabhupada, we sung Sri Guru Charana Padma, which is the expression of Narottam Das Thakur's love for his Guru Maharaj, Lokanath Goswami. It is the standard and the example.
Hari Hari Vipale Janama Gonainu Manusya Janama Paya Radha Krishna Nabhajiya.
In this beautiful song that Srila Prabhupada loved so much, Narottam Das Thakur is singing the humility of his heart. I have been born in this world with this human form of life, which is so precious, so rare. Why is the human form of life so rare? Because unlike any other species, it gives us the opportunity to awaken our love for God. But how unfortunate I am that although given every opportunity, I have wasted so many precious moments of my life without serving you, Radha and Krishna.
Dinahina yata chilo harinamu thadilo thara sakshi jagai madhai.
But you have so mercifully appeared in the vibration of your name, my Lord, and can deliver the hearts of everyone and anyone who sincerely takes your name.
I would like to speak briefly about another great personality who had a unique and extraordinary absorption in his spiritual essence. He lived long before Narottam Das Thakur. In fact, this personality I'm speaking about is one of the most worshipped saints in South India, even today. He lived thousands of years ago. He was a king in the royal order. His name, Kulashekar. Shall I tell something? Maharaj Kulashekar is worshipped in thousands of temples as a saint in the Sri Sampradaya, the principal temples of South India. He was born in the dynasty of the Chera dynasty. Their capital was Trivandrum. During the British time, it was called Travancore, and now it is called Tiruvananthapur. That was the place where his forefather kings resided. They had a great tradition. All of the kings of the Chera dynasty considered that Lord Krishna, in his form in the temple of Ananta Padmanabh, was the king. And they were simply meant to be the vessels of his will on earth. They were like the trustees. But he was the proprietor. Krishna was the proprietor, the controller of everything. Therefore, every single day, for generation after generation after generation, each king would come before the Lord in the temple 2 times, morning and evening, and give a report of all the daily activities within the kingdom. Kulashekar Maharaj was born in that atmosphere. His father's name was Dhritavrata, great king. And he wanted to train his son to be an excellent servant of humanity.
He learned all the arts of war, government. He learned the arts of the Holy Scriptures. He studied the four Vedas, the 18 Puranas, the Itihastas, the six Shastras. He was so profoundly expert at everything he did that when he was just a young man, he was coronated as the king. And his father retired. How he ruled over the citizens. He was so great that he became the king of the entire South India, Dravida Desh. Now, for those of you who understand the ancient history of that part of the world, there were predominantly three dynasties of kings. There was the Chola dynasty, who had their capital in Kanchipuram, the Pandya dynasty, who had their capital in Madurai, and the Chera dynasty, who had their capital in Trivandrum. King Kulashekar attracted people's hearts to trust him so much that he became the king of all the three regions, Chola, Pandya, and Chera dynasties. And all the kings from other provinces, they were all subordinate to him. He was emperor. So powerful. He had trained his military to be undefeatable. But also, he was so fair. He had such integrity. There was such perfect justice within his community that all the citizens loved him like the sons and daughters loved their father. And he treated all the citizens as his own children. The weak felt strong under his command. And the strong were always in check of not becoming overwhelmed with their wealth and power. Under his check. He ruled the kingdom for several years. Although he was materially very wise, he was spiritually blind. And therefore, he fell to false egoism. What does spiritual blindness mean? In essence, it's a concept of life where we are conceited. We think ourselves to be the doer of activities. We want to take credit for all the good things that we do. We want to consider ourselves the proprietors of what we have. But in truth, it is also temporary. It is the Supreme Lord who is the proprietor of everything. And in this world, if we're honest, whatever we have, we should know we are the caretakers of the Lord. And therefore, we should utilize what God gives us according to the will of the Lord. Then there's no karma. That is bhakti. That is love. We don't have to give things away, but we use everything in a spirit of servitude, understanding our relationship with the Supreme. That is love. That is knowledge. That is truth. And we understand whatever knowledge, whatever abilities we may have, is God-given. Humanity is bound to God by dependence. And God is bound to humanity with independence. Humanity is bound to God by being governed or protected by Him. And God is bound to humanity as the governor and the protector. The Upanishads declare Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Eko Bahumam Yovadadati Kamam, which means there is one supreme eternal being, and there are also unlimited eternal beings. There is the Supreme Lord, Parabrahman, and there is the spirit souls, Brahman. And the unlimited beings are always subordinate to the one supreme being. To understand our relationship with God in that spirit is light and knowledge. King Kulashekar was very much intoxicated, and therefore he could not see things as they were. But by the grace of God, mysteriously, something started changing in his heart. His world view was being transformed. He was seeing the egoism of this world. His values were changing. Sattva-guna, the mode of goodness, awakens the thirst for spirituality. Rajaguna and Tamaguna, the modes of passion and ignorance, awaken a thirst for those things that further bind us within this world. King Kulashekar, he was experiencing the futility of life without God. And at the same time, he was getting a glimpse of the essence of Krishna, the beauty of God, the glory of God. And he was feeling great bliss. At that state, he was yearning for spiritual enlightenment. And it is said, by the mercy of Krishna, one gets Guru, and by the mercy of Guru, one gets Krishna. Lord Narayan sent the great Vikshvakshena to be the spiritual master of King Kulashekar. He initiated him in the Pancha Samskaras and instructed him in the science of spirituality. King Kulashekar became so intoxicated with love of God. He was thinking in his mind, that all my life I've been so proud, so vain, and now I see the emptiness of it all. And I look around at how the world is living. People are simply living like dead corpses without understanding their spiritual essence. So much striving and trampling over each other's heads to fulfill their own selfish desires. I don't want a part of this anymore. To be with such people is like being strangled by the rope of the gallows. And here I am, a big king, riding on the royal elephant, being glorified and celebrated by all my citizens. But now I'm feeling this vanity to be like enveloped by the flames of a burning fire. Like Vibhishan, I will seek shelter of the Lord of my heart. And he wrote a beautiful prayer. Actually, King Kulashekar, after hearing the scriptures, he took the essence
and wrote a book that is one of the most celebrated spiritual classics in India, even today, thousands of years later, the Mukunda Mala Stotra. The garland of essential truths of Lord Mukunda. He was thinking, I will go to Rangakshetra, to the temple in Srirangam, and there I will surrender my life to the Supreme Lord and always keep the company of His loving devotees. But somehow to pacify himself and carry on with his duties as king, he was inviting great saintly scholars and sages to visit him in his palace. And they would read the scriptures to him. They were reading the 18 Puranas, the Itihastas, the Mahabharata. And he organized within his palace every day a reading from Ramayana, the life and teachings of the incarnation of the Lord Sri Ramchandra, son of Dasarath. He became so absorbed. Although he was performing all his duties as a king to the citizens, protecting them, providing for them perfectly, he was absorbed so deeply in Krishna. I will give an example. They were reading Valmiki Ramayana, and there was a beautiful verse describing how after Suparnaka was insulted, she told Kara and Dushan, the two brothers of Ravana, what had happened. And in Panchavati, which is today Nasik, Kara and Dushan attacked Lord Ram with 14,000 Rakshasa soldiers. They had chariots and horses. They were equipped with the most dangerous weapons of the day. Seeing this vast army of 14,000 soldiers rapidly approaching, Ram told Lakshman to take Sita to a secluded place and protect her. And Ram stood alone with his bow and arrow to fight the entire army. And Valmiki Muni asked the question, how could Lord Ram alone combat against so many trained military men? When King Kulashekar heard that line, how could Ram fight this battle alone? It was as if it lit a fire of wrath in his heart. He jumped up and he said, Ram is alone in Panchavati. Immediately, all of my armies, we will march to Panchavati. And carrying our best of weapons, we will fight against Ravana. If we are his devotees, how could we allow him to be alone in such a situation? Let us go immediately with no time to waste. And Kulashekar got on his chariot and commanded all of his armies to follow close behind him. His ministers didn't know what to do. Ramayana is a history of a story that happened millions of years ago. But King Kulashekar, when he was hearing it, he was living it today. He was marching, so angry, they were rapidly going. So his ministers, what are we going to do? The king has gone mad with devotion. They made a plan. They sent a small army way ahead to go around him and in front of him. And then they came from in front of him back to him
And the army said, "We have just come from Panchavati, Nasik. And we're happy to tell you, dear king, that Ramchandra single-handedly slayed all the 14,000 Rakshasas. And now he's united with Sita and he's very happy." King Kulashekar was in excessive bliss to hear this. "Oh, my lord is victorious." And he went back to his kingdom and had a big celebration in the victory of the Lord. So from that day on, during the Ramayana readings, they were very selective of what they would read. Any happy parts of Ramayana, they would read with great enthusiasm. But any situation where Ram was in danger or Sita was in danger, or any situation where there was sadness, they would either gloss over it or they would avoid it altogether. Now, King Kulashekar, he was living the Ramayana. He was not just reading a history of thousands of years ago. He was living it. As he was hearing it, any important event that took place in Ramayana, he dedicated his entire capital of his kingdom to celebrate it. Every day there was a festival. Today Ram did this, and he would spend large sums of money, and he would just have beautiful darshans and beautiful aartis and beautiful decorations, and he would feed all the Vaishnavas, and he would feed all the common people, and he would give charity to the poor. It was fantastic. Every day it was like this. His whole kingdom was nothing but festival after festival after festival because of the events that Ram was performing. One day, his reading guru was sent on an important mission by someone. So his son read that day. But they forgot to tell the son about King Kulashekar's divine sentiments. So he was just reading everything. And he came to the portion of Ramayana where Ravana kidnaps Sita and forcibly drags her to his kingdom of Sri Lanka, where she was under an Ashok tree being harassed and terrorized by him daily. Kulashekar heard this. His heart exploded with wrath. He jumped up, he started screaming out, "Immediately, assemble all of the armies, and I will lead you. We will march across the ocean to Sri Lanka. I will burn that city to ashes. I will slay that demon Ravana and all of his relatives. And I will rescue the weeping Sita, my mother, my life and soul, and return her to Ram. Now let us go." He picked up his sword, he picked up his bows and his arrows, he boarded his chariot, and as fast as a wind he was going forward, and his armies were following. They didn't know what to do. Queen Kulashekar was so intense in his devotion that when they got to the ocean, he didn't even stop to think how we're going to cross it. He just got off his chariot and just started running into the ocean with his sword over his head. Hare Krishna. And he got up to his neck and he was still going. And his ministers, they didn't know what to do. It was shocking. They were staggered. They couldn't say a single word. But this was critical. It's hundreds of miles of ocean. And he's running. It's going up and up and up. He starts swimming with a sword in his hand to rescue Sita.
At that point,
when it was that crucial moment of life and death for him,
he didn't even consider it. But something wonderful happened. Approaching from in front of him was his beloved Lord Rama, with Sita holding his arm.
Lord Sri Ramchandra with his eternal consort Sita
appeared before King Kulashekar because of his unmotivated love. And Ram said to Kulashekar, when he was swimming in the water with his swords and his shields, he said, "I'm just coming from Sri Lanka." He said, "We just defeated Ravana. He's finished. The whole Sri Lanka is now under the rule of the great devotee Vibhishan. And look, Sita's with my, she's at my side now." And Sita said, "Yes, I'm safe. I'm with Ram again." He said, "By your prayers, Maharaj Kulashekar, by your prayers, we were victorious. Now, you should return home to your own kingdom." And Ram said, "I will lift you up and carry you back to your palace, just as I lift the fallen souls out of the ocean of birth and death and bring them to my home in the spiritual world." Sri Ramchandra then lifted up King Kulashekar and brought him back to the shore and brought him back to the palace. Now the ministers, after this event, they didn't know what to do with this king. Was he eccentric? He was just absorbed in ecstatic love, beyond time and place of this world. But the ministers were thinking he had a disease, and we have to deal with this disease. So they had a big meeting, and they came to the conclusion that the disease was he's associating with devotees, and they're making him mad like this. But at the same time, he's always longing to go to the holy place of Sri Rangam, which is the capital of holy places within South India for the Sri Sampradaya. If he goes to Sri Rangam and sees the beautiful form of Vishnu and associates with devotees there, then he may never come back and we won't have a king. But at the same time, the only thing that's keeping him from going is every time he says he's going, we always send devotees to just happen to come, and then he serves them so nicely. He can't leave them. It's the devotees that keep him here, but it's also the devotees that are making him mad. What is this? It's like between a rock and a hard place. If we remove the devotees, he'll go. If we don't remove the devotees, then he's like this. So they were thinking, these devotees are everywhere. He's just inviting them from all directions. And he gives them free access to his court, to his palace, to his private chambers. And he treats every devotee with such respect, he lets them do anything and everything. And when we ask him, "Why are you doing like this? Why are you letting these Vaishnavas just do anything everywhere? And you, whatever occupation you are doing in the kingdom, as soon as a devotee comes, you drop everything to serve them." And his reply is, that my realization is, by serving a devotee of the Lord, it is as good as serving the Lord for 60,000 years.
Hare Krishna.
This was his realization. So they came to a conclusion. The only way to cure this disease, should I continue? Is we have to break his faith in devotees. We have to prove to him that these Vaishnavas are corrupt. Then he'll lose his faith and he'll come back to a normal state of ruling his kingdom. Then they made a plot. In his palace, he had a beautiful deity of Lord Rama. And Rama had wonderful jewelry. And it was the Sri Vaishnavas, the devotees, that were taking care of all the deity worship. We will steal the deity's most precious necklace. And then we will prove that it was the devotees who, out of greed and envy, stole it from God. Ah, they were very excited about this plot. So the ministers themselves stole this precious necklace. And then they reported to the king that the Lord's necklace has been stolen. And we have done an investigation. It is those devotees. It is the Sri Vaishnavas. Out of their greed, they have stolen it. We are going to take them to trial and we're going to do justice to them. We will punish them according to the law. When King Kulasekara heard this, they were telling all the details of the investigation. He stood up from his throne and with a voice like thunder, he said, "I will not hear any more of this. This is not possible. A Vaishnav will never steal. Even in the farthest reaches of the mind of a Vaishnav, such a thought could never cross them. A Vaishnav is a devotee of God. A Vaishnav is pure. A Vaishnav would never, ever yield to such corruption. I will prove to you my faith in the innocence of these devotees. Immediately, my servant, immediately, bring me a vessel which is inhabited by a venomous cobra." Immediately. "I will stick my hand in that prison house for this venomous snake. And if it bites me, then let me die. But if these devotees are innocent, there is nothing that can happen against me." And then Kulasekara, without a single thought, he thrust his hand and his entire arm into a vessel that was the abode of a hungry, venomous serpent. And he held it in there and took it out completely pure and whole. At that point, the ministers realized, "He is too much for us. This is just too much." His faith in God and his faith in the devotees of God is unshakable. So they bowed at his feet and they were just repentant and they brought him back the necklace and they said, "Actually, we stole it. We thought you were going crazy, so we have framed, we have set up and incriminated these innocent devotees. We beg forgiveness of you." And King Kulasekara, just like Ram, forgave Kakasura, the crow that defiled the sanctity of Sita. Kulasekara forgave them. He said, "You are forgiven. Carry on with your services. But you should not accuse innocent people. The atonement is you should serve them." That was the last thing they wanted to hear. But after this incident, Maharaj Kulashekar was thinking in his heart, why am I living with these vile, shameless, scheming ministers? It's like living in blazing fire. And so much of the world is like this. And with this in mind, he coronated his son, Dhritabrata, named after grandfather, as the king. And Kulashekar Maharaj went to Srirangam, where he spent the rest of his life living very simple, doing humble service to the Lord, and doing humble service to the Lord's devotees, constantly absorbed in hearing the glorious pastimes and chanting his holy names. And as he was leaving, he wrote a beautiful verse. In this verse, he speaks that man has given me a crown, saying that I'm the king. But my Lord, you are the King of Kings. And I am in my most elevated position when the crown on my head is your lotus feet. This is not just a story. King Kulashekar's writings and his example is honored even today by hundreds of millions of people. And one beautiful thing we could learn from this story is how extraordinary it is to be absorbed. When we read the Holy Scriptures, we should not think that this is simply something that has happened. King Kulashekar was living in the present moment. That was his absorption. In this world, the Bhagavad Gita explains, there are situations beyond our control. Old age, disease, death, so many reversals. Whoever we may be, to try to be the controller in a world where we have such temporary and limited control is a very frustrating situation. But by simply humbling ourselves, and understanding the supreme control of the Lord, and understanding the beauty and the love of the Lord, and reciprocating with that love in this very life, we can access the supreme happiness, and we can share that happiness with others. As it is said, in giving we receive. Giving of our heart. That is culture. Real culture is about respect and service to others, with the ultimate goal of pleasing God. Mahatma Gandhi was asked by a British reporter, you have lived in the West, What is your opinion of Western culture? And Gandhi's famous reply was, my opinion is it's a good idea. Which means he just didn't see any culture. He saw tremendous material progress in science and technology and legislation. But real culture is about respect, about service, it's about humility, it's about real faith in God. Now, certainly these qualities are present all over the world. But wherever they're prominent, that is a cultured person. That is a cultured environment. And here in India, which has such a deep culture of humility, respect, service, and devotion, it is rapidly dwindling. Just the other day, Niranjan Swami Maharaj's sister, who's an administrator of hospitals in Boston, Massachusetts, of the United States of America, she was expressing her heart. How sacred and important tradition is. During our parents' time, even in America, there was tradition. But as the generation passed, those traditions were considered to be irrelevant and counterproductive. How sacred! Tradition that upholds and preserves sanctified values is. And India, through hundreds of years of Mughal rule, through hundreds of years of British rule, preserved its culture and tradition to a very large extent. But in the past 25 years, that ancient and sacred tradition has disintegrated more than it has in thousands of years. Symbolic. I read in one magazine that the deterioration of the Taj Mahal has been greater in the last 25 years than in the centuries and centuries and centuries since it's been built. Because of the acid rains and the pollutions. That's the way the culture of life is becoming as well. Our Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, he explained it in a very nice way. He said that Yukta Vairagya, technology, science, progressive medicine and transportation, they are not bad. They are good if they are supported by proper values. But otherwise, they can disintegrate the integrity of human beings if we become too much obsessed with these things. Srila Prabhupada said that, of course, this was back in the 1960s and 70s. India is a poor country, like a lame man. And the West, very powerful physically, but quite blind. But if the blind man gets on the shoulders, I'm sorry, if the lame man gets on the shoulders of the blind man who has strength, then together they can make great progress.
So taking the achievements, the modern achievements of the West, and combining them with the wisdom and the value of the traditions of the East can give such great benefit to the whole world. My dear friend Gary, last time we were here, I told a little portion of the story of our relationship together. And because most of you are the same people, and you've been watching the video, I didn't want to tell the same story again. So I just went off into a tangent like King Kulashekar and just started talking. But Gary and I were talking. And the India that he visited in 1971 when he first came, and the India he sees today, is very much a different place. There are many modern facilities that give a lot of comfort to a Westerner. There's bottled water. Gary and I were getting typhoid and dysentery and amoebic cysts and all these things all over the place every day practically in those days because we just drank any well water anyone gave us. But even if there was bottled water in those days, we couldn't afford it. But there are many conveniences which make us feel, make a foreign person who's come after 30 years feel safer. But at the same time, to see how rapidly people's consciousness have degraded, how rapidly traditions are disintegrating, it's very worrisome and it's very sad. Because that's the greatest thing the people of India have. Traditions based on deep philosophy and scientific spiritual knowledge. Traditions which uphold honesty, integrity, simplicity, and purity. That are always keeping us connected to divinity. And it is a wonderful thing that I see here at Avanti and Yasha's home. Although they have very modern ways, in many ways, they're raising their children with very, very beautiful values and traditions. Last year we went to Vrindavan and did Govardhan Parikrama. Yes? It's several of our brahmacharis, who are staunch, austere sadhus, they were there. And for those of you who have done, how many here have done Govardhan Parikrama? It's walking around the sanctified mountain of Govardhan Hill, which is 21 kilometers. And we all did it, according to tradition, with bare feet. And some of the adults, I'm not going to go into details, but they were really struggling. But these three children, Vedanta, Nirvana, and little Sloka, they were blissfully dancing around the hill. Nirvana was leading us. So enthusiastic. These brahmacharis, by the end of the Govardhan Parikrama, I've never seen them like this. They were practically taking the dust of Sloka's feet. They were praising her, a little girl. How enthusiastic. What natural sentiments are imbibed within her. So we're very proud to see this effort, and it's a nice example.
It's a very nice example. The Bhagavad Gita tells yad yad acharati sreshtas tad tad evite rojana sayat pramanam kurute lokas tad anuvartate.
What leaders and influential people in society do, the common people will follow.
And how important it is that people with influence uphold the integrity and the values of the sacred ideals that our forefathers and the saints have given to us. Because the purpose of human life is to purify the heart, to love God, and to be an instrument of God's love in everything we do in life. There is nothing else that will give us the joy and the meaning and fulfillment as that. And beyond that, it awakens the eternal essence of our existence, our eternal relation with the Lord.
In this age of Kali, the chanting of the holy names is so simple. It purifies the heart. But if we want to chant properly, we have to live with humility and proper spiritual values. Srila Prabhupada, he taught very strongly that philosophy and religion without good character is all useless. So to live with good character, to imbibe that within our children, and to inspire that in the hearts of those around us, that is true dharma. And the greatest of all good character is to be an instrument of God's love, which could be accessed by all of us by sincerely chanting his holy names.
And I'd like to conclude my short talk tonight by expressing my deep gratitude to Gary and his younger brother, Richard. Richard is here. I grew up with both of these celebrated personalities from early childhood through the various transitions of life. Whenever they come, I'm a little fearful of what they may say about my past, because I have no control over them. But it doesn't matter. Why should we? We are what we are. But I'm so very, very happy that they have come. I remember we were from a little village in northern Illinois called Highland Park. And there just wasn't anything to do. And when you're a teenager in America, you're always looking for something to do. And on Saturday night, all week we'd go to school waiting for Saturday night. Then Saturday night, Gary and Richard would pick me up in their car and some of our other friends. We go in the car, say, what will we do tonight? Say, well, let's look for something to do. And we go this place and that place looking for something to do. And by about midnight, we realize there's nothing to do. It's that accurate? So it was a simple life. But it was a very nice, pious neighborhood. And for a teenage boy, a pious neighborhood means there's nothing to do. In America. So by God's grace, there was nothing to do. We were protected. But I love them very much. Even though I'm so different, they accept me. And it's a beautiful relationship. They will be leaving back for Malibu, California, the day after tomorrow. Would either of you like to give parting words to our congregation? Because this is the last chance you'll have to speak. You could come up on stage if you like. Gary, you can also come. Now is the time I have to pray to Krishna. Before you begin, Gary and Richard, I would just like to inform you that I'm intensely praying to Krishna that you will say the right things. And more than that, I'm praying that you don't say the wrong things.
Hello.
Richard is a highly specialized massage therapist, and Gary is a physical trainer in the Malibu gym.
Does it work? Yeah. Thank you, Swami. Thank you very much. From the moment I walked off the plane almost 2 weeks ago, I've been treated with such unbelievable warmth and affection, and I still don't know why, what I've done to deserve all this. And I know that it's because you all love Swami so much as I do. And from the bottom of my heart, I thank you all, and so much love I've received from several of the devotees who have spent as much time as we wanted, doing what we wanted, and so much more. I'm not going to say all your names, but you know who you are, and I do want to thank you so much. You know, at home, I have a lot of friends, but sometimes I can't even find somebody to have dinner with, and here, there's so many people that want to have dinner with me that I don't know who to have dinner with. And at home, it's really hard to find somebody to take you to the airport with all the traffic we have in LA. And here, even at 5 a.m, there's a dozen people that want to take me to the airport. So I'm just so deeply, deeply touched, and I'm so honored to be here. And I'm still wondering what I've done to deserve all this, but maybe I'll be wondering for the rest of my life. Thank you all. Namaste.
It's good to be back in Bombay. It's good to be back here. I think some of you, or most of you, remember me last year. So it's really an honor and privilege to be back with all you wonderful people. I was so moved and touched and fulfilled last year by my visit that I decided I had to share it with some people in my life that mean a lot to me. So this year, I didn't come alone. I came with two good friends, Lynn and Devin, who left today. But they asked me to once again express to you their love and gratitude for all that everyone here has done for them. And I also brought my mother's sister, my lovely Aunt Shelley, who left earlier, and she also asked me to tell you once again how grateful she is. And she hopes, we all hope, that some of you will come visit us in America someday so we can show you some love and affection like you've done for us. And Shelley is an interesting woman. She owns a professional basketball team, so she wants to take all of you to the game if any of you are ever in L.A. during the season. By the way, I'll just mention briefly, she's owned the team for many, many years, for like over 20 years, and they've never been a winning team. They've always been a terrible team. So this year, she decided, because they're such a terrible team, she could come to India and not miss very much. But to her, all of our amazement, they're having the best season they've ever had. They're 12 games over 500, and they're in the thick of the playoff hunt, and she gives all credit to Maharaj and to the devotees and to Lord Krishna. So, Hare Krishna, thank you. And I am so happy to have brought my family and my friends here, some of them, to have seen for themselves all the love and hospitality that you gave to me last year, and it's totally been extended to them. And speaking for all of them, I thank you so much. I'm so moved. I feel so much love for all of you. And but most of all, for Maharaj, I don't think I'm going to embarrass him. His prayers probably are going to be answered. There really isn't much to embarrass him about, though. I've searched my mind for things that might be of interest to you about him. And there's many interesting things, but very few embarrassing things, because he's always been such a wonderful, wonderful person, you know. He's my example, my hero. You know, he says that that the actions of our lives determine our future, you know, that what we do now determines our karma for our next birth. And I must have done something really good in my last life to have had a friend like Maharaj for 40 years. I think about it and I don't even feel worthy of it. And yet, when I look into his beautiful face, I see he truly loves me in spite of my entanglement in the web of Maya. Is that how you say it? Which to me is just amazing. He just doesn't judge me or have high expectations of me, other than that I give him my love, and that is always going to be unconditional. I know every one of you here understand that, because I know you all feel the same way. And so I love you more than as much as any human being I've ever loved, and thank you so much for everything you've given me for the past 40 years. Now, is there anybody that wants me to embarrass him? No, I won't do that. I'm sorry. And I don't know what else to say except thank you again. And with your blessings, we would like your permission to come back again next year. And if there's any questions that you have, either of myself or my brother Richard, we would be very happy to answer them. Otherwise, we'd be happy to turn it over back to Maharaj.
One thing. Next year he's going to bring a whole carload of them, a whole plane load of them.
The floor is all yours, my friend Maharaj. Thank you.
Thank you, Prabhu. Thank you very much. You can stay, please. Shall we have kirtan? Would everyone like to dance? Please.